Today's talk is given by John Carthy, Senior Marine Archaeologist at Wessex Archaeology here in Edinburgh. His talk is entitled GIS Applications in Professional Archaeology. John has worked on a variety of projects, including Bronze Age, Iron Age, and medieval sites, as well as work on heritage, development, environmental impact analysis, such things. John's also contributed to and led various projects in specialist marine and coastal work, which is of particular interest, hence the poster photo that I found. And that also utilises technologies such as high-grade survey, GIS analysis and visualisation. So this should all mean he's perfectly placed to deliver this year's opening seminar, which is themed to complement our newly launched MSc GIS and Archaeology. So without further ado, over to John.
Hi. Thanks for the introduction, and thanks to Owen for the invitation. My name is John McCarthy, and I'm going to just be talking about the way we use GIS in archaeology and Wessex archaeology where I work. My own background in I studied archaeology and history in Trinity College Dublin. I'm from Ireland, obviously. I didn't do any GIS there, but I worked in archaeological fieldwork around Ireland for about 4 or 5 years, and then ended up going to do an MPhil in Queen's University in Belfast, and I was looking at tower houses. And as part of that project, I ended up using quite a lot of GIS and getting into it there. And after that, I worked on for a couple of years on various fieldwork projects again, and ended up going to Scotland, working for Headland Archaeology for about 4 years. And for the last 2 years, I've been working in the Edinburgh office of Wessex Archaeology, doing a lot of coastal and marine stuff, and doing a lot of GIS stuff as well. I'm also a part-time student at Lund University in Sweden, studying for a GIS master's. So I picked up a few tricks from that, but still halfway through that. A few words about Wessex Archaeology. I'm not sure if anyone is familiar with Wessex Archaeology. We're a UK-wide company, an educational charity technically. We have about 125 staff altogether. That can go as high as about 250 or 300 if we have a big fieldwork project on. We specialise in coastal and marine. About half of the company does mainly coastal and marine stuff, offshore, coastal, and the other half does more standard archaeological fieldwork of various kinds. If you haven't heard of Wessex Archaeology, you may have heard of Time Team, and this is our celebrity archaeologist, Phil Harding, who probably doesn't like that picture. As a company and as an educational charity, we have a couple of objectives that relate to heritage. We're working on quite a lot of pre-development projects where we're hired in on a contract basis to undertake archaeological studies and mitigation, fieldwork, recording, so on. So we try to get in early in those kind of projects and help the clients to design projects in a way that's going to have the least possible damage to an archaeological site. For mitigation works, we do all sorts of test pitting, evaluation, excavation, geotechnical works, geophysical survey, etc., etc. And we try to ensure that all of our projects, whether they be research or pre-development, contribute to the research questions that are most relevant. On the one hand, we have our pre-development clients who might want us to resolve their archaeological problems when they want to build something. But on the other hand, we also have to comply with a wide variety of standards and legislation. Those are the main ones that we worry about. Scottish planning policy is relatively new. It controls the planning process in Scotland. The various disciplines, including cultural heritage. Since we do so much offshore coastal work, we're often come up against the Marine Act. And then we also have a very wide variety of professional standards that we have to adhere to. Wessex Archaeology is a registered organisation with the IFA, and we're all the staff in Wessex Archaeology are IFA members. The IFA publish a lot of guidance on various standards for types of field work and for conduct as an archaeologist. This talk is about GIS, which is your main interest, I suppose. I asked a colleague for a slide about some of the GIS presentations he'd been doing down in England, and he had a slide about what GIS is, and it would have taken you about half an hour to read. GIS is just geographic information systems, not necessarily just the simple GIS hardware that we think about immediately. It can include everything from Photoshop to even the way that you deal with your data. Mostly I'm going to be talking about survey and ArcGIS, various other more straightforward GIS things today. The way that we deal with GIS in Wessex Archaeology is mainly, as I said, through ArcGIS. We're moving over to ArcGIS 10 at the moment, which is quite painful, but we're working through it. We also use a couple of freeware programs like GRASS and HBR programs like HBSMR. And we often use databases like Excel and Access to link to our GIS programs. For ArcGIS, we have, in a company of 125 people, we have 25 licenses, which mean only 25 people at any one time in the company can access ArcGIS. And that's usually not a problem. I have occasionally not been able to get access, but so something about one in five people might be using ArcGIS at any one time, including people who are out in the field. So we have a pretty heavy use of the software. As well as the licenses, we have our own PCs. Everyone gets their own PC in the company. But we also have a couple of dedicated geospatial PCs, very powerful computers based in Salisbury, and we have one up in Edinburgh. And they're used for undertaking very complex, intensive data processing for things like marine geophysics, photogrammetry, and so on. We organize our data internally into a series of GIS data stores. They're mainly held on the servers in our head office, and we use synchronized clones in our regional offices. The GIS data stores include all sorts of data from various projects we've been involved with over the years, and from people like the BGS and so on. And that makes it very easy when we start a project to just draw in a whole variety of background data to assist in our project. To deal with the increasing complexity of managing spatial data in the company, in the last couple of years, we've put together a geomatics team, which is led by Paul Cripps in our head office. And we also have a team of about six people who do survey and GIS and all that kind of stuff. In each of our regional offices, we have a dedicated data officer. In our office in Edinburgh, it's Andy Bickett, who some of you will know. And that person is responsible for organizing all the data, making sure that the metadata is dealt with correctly, making sure that projections and transformations are adequately done, and that there's a paperwork trail, and so on and so on. I've split what we do with GIS in Wessex into five categories. We use it for field data capture, where we'll get spatial data in the field, and we'll either bring it directly into a program like ArcGIS, or we'll store it and then upload it later on. Data synthesis is probably the main thing that we use GIS for, just drawing together different data sources and Illustrator or Photoshop, as I've seen in other companies I work in. I worked in, we'll do all of our map outputs through ArcGIS, which is a lot faster and easier, in my opinion. We also do some GIS training stuff as well. I'll go into some detail on that later on. Field data capture, mobile GIS. Depending on the purpose of why we're gathering field data, we'll use a variety of different systems, and they can be classified from less to more accurate. PDAs and smartphones being less accurate, and total stations and GNSS being the most accurate available to us. Smartphones and PDAs. I was going to bring a PDA down, but I forgot. It's just a, you've probably seen it yourselves, you may have a couple here. A small handheld computer just fits in the pocket. Very useful, but the accuracy on those kind of things can be around 5 meters, which is slightly limited. The best thing that we use that for is we can use it for walkover surveys, where all we need from a site is to know where the site is. So we might be up in the Highlands and find a cairn or something, and we're not there to do a full survey. We only want to flag it up for later work. So we'll just get you know, 5 meters is fine for that. You can, as well as capturing data, you can access data. You can put background mapping on these things to help you. You can put rectified crop marks, things like that. We can push that data out using. There's a lot of complex ways you can do it, but there's a couple of very easy ways, which is just to use ArcGIS online, Google Maps, things like that. We had a recent project where we made a virtual tour of Stonehenge using Google Maps, where people could take their phones or computers out into the environment, or they could just do it from home if they wanted, and get around all the monuments and see photographs and videos and interpretations. Mobile mapper is a bit more accurate. We use that for various types of field works. It's a bit less expensive than the top of the range stuff. It's also very portable, fits in the pocket. It's much more accurate, and again, you can do a lot of stuff with data on it, take data off, create data, and so on. And then for projects where we need the most accuracy, we'll use a total station theodolite and DGNSS or DGPS, which can give you very, very accurate decimetric accuracy. Those things can be very expensive, which is why you have to always lock your car when you're out from those. And you can use that, you can hook that up to a Toughnode or a laptop or something, get straight into your data right away. This is Heathrow Terminal 5. This is a project that they did down in head office. And that's just an example of a total station survey. You can see how much data they've captured and how important it would be for a project like that to capture it in an intelligent way so that you can then pull out all the information most of it. This slide here shows an example of post-excavation analysis. In this case, I think it's environmental. They're looking at pollen counts in various archaeological features, and this just makes it very easy to, GIS makes it very easy to visualize what you're trying to understand. We can use that data when you've captured a site using a digital workflow like that in GIS. It's very easy to then push that data out to the community for dissemination purposes. This is also Terminal 5. We've made a free GIS viewer, not ours, someone else's. And all our data available through a website. So anyone who's interested in this excavation can just go to that website, Framearc, and they can download the viewer, and they can look through all the various aspects of the project, anything that the archaeologists themselves could see. They can symbolize things differently, they can do all sorts of analysis. They can pull up section drawings, they can look at the stratigraphy, they can look at the photographs. Some very nice finds on that project. We also use GIS to capture data for diver tracking. This is a picture of me from a couple of weeks ago diving off the east coast of Scotland, off East Lothian. Don't look like a Christmas tree. Gear all over me. If you look over on the left hand side, just almost out of the shot, you can see a little cylinder strapped to the back of my air cylinder. That's a sonar transponder, and we can use that to track the diver from the boat and feed the diver's position directly into an MXD on the boat, which makes it very easy to record archaeological observations. We also have a comms cell strapped to the side of my head there where I can talk to the people on the boat and they can talk to me, so I can ask them to make an observation when I find something. So very useful for control and safety. And then as well, you can add background data into your MXD and that can help you guide the divers. That's a diagram of how the diver tracking system works. See the transceiver on the boat under the hull and the transponder on the diver. The diver there is tethered, but they don't necessarily need to be. That's linked to a GPS on the boat, which you put an offset into your transceiver. That's an example of the setup on the same job, where divers moving along with generated tracks as they go. And then you can see individual artifacts have been recorded as well. That's so we can turn around to clients and we can say, we may not have found anything, but you know, you've surveyed this area. So we keep the tracking on all the time. We use GIS quite a lot for some very straightforward projects which don't involve a lot of analysis. One of these is one we did with the commission. Where we just gather data from a wide variety of sources and we'll bring it together, and it will allow heritage managers and people to make decisions about how to manage sites and how to deal with planning, wide-scale planning. The Scottish Marine Data Audit was a piece of work, one of the first jobs I did for Wessex, where we took as many data sets as we could get relating to coastal and marine environments and brought them together. We've got about 50 data sets. That one there is multispectral imaging from one of the commercial providers. These are all done from our office in Edinburgh. We did a characterization of Scotland's marine archaeological resource where we took all the known offshore sites and did some analysis on that and brought them all together. At the moment, we're working on a paleo landscapes audit for English Heritage, which is a similar kind of project, just bringing together existing data. Our main workflow for GIS, as I said, is data synthesis. Increasingly, there's more and more GIS data available, and for a developer or a researcher or a planning officer, trying to understand all that data can be prohibitive. So they'll hire us in or get us in to just boil it all down and make it straightforward. There's three kinds of desk-based work that we mainly do. A desk-based assessment is just looking at an area, gathering all the heritage data that's available. An environmental impact assessment, which is an area I work in quite a lot, is where you take that baseline data and then you look at the development. Try and look, you try to draw out what the impacts will be of the development. If it's a wind farm, will the turbines be sited on archaeological features and so on, and how significant is that? We also do some strategic environmental assessments where there's no particular development within business, but planners might be looking for zoning in different areas, and so you have to take a very broad view across a large area and try and pull in all the heritage data. When we start to do a piece of desk-based research like that, we pull together sources from all over the place. They'll be defined at the start of the project, otherwise projects could be totally open-ended. But they can include a huge variety of different things. I won't go through all of those. Luckily for us, and for developers and researchers like yourselves, heritage data is increasingly available already in GIS format. And these are the logos of some of the most important GIS heritage data providers. Some of them are mapping companies, some of them are local authorities, state agencies, the Royal Commission, the British Geological Survey, the UKHO does all the offshore stuff, etc., etc. We can take all that data at the start of a project and bring it all nicely together and then present the client with a much simpler picture of what's going on. This is our basic workflow. Draw all the data together, synthesize it, and turn it into a geodatabase of some kind. A geodatabase could be an Excel spreadsheet with coordinates for different archaeological features. It could be an access database with a dynamic link to ArcGIS. It could be just shape files. But the main point is to bring it all together. From that geodatabase, different people in the company do it in different ways, but we can produce a gazetteer of all the archaeological features. We can output shape files to whoever's contracted us in so that they can then add it to their own data sets, and we use it for producing maps as well. In the company, we mainly do synthesis, but we also, for various projects, do some spatial data analysis. It's very hard to kind of encapsulate that in a slideshow because it varies so much from one project to another. So what I'm going to do is just run through a couple of different projects where we've done more complex spatial data analysis. The four kinds of data analysis that we mainly do are georeferencing and accuracy analysis. So I've just lumped those together because in ArcGIS they're quite similar. They work. Viewshed analysis is something that is used quite a lot in an academic context, and we use it a lot for planning studies and trying to understand the visual impacts of the development on a cultural heritage site. So if you had a battlefield or something and you're worried about a power station being built next to it, you can use viewsheds to try and calculate how much that impact will be. Interpolation from samples to create continuous data surfaces. We mainly use that for topography, but we can use it for a whole variety of other things. And aside from viewshed analysis, we also do some other raster-based analysis. We can do cedar-level modeling, things like that. Georeferencing is quite straightforward. This example is from the National Library of Scotland website. It's a great project they have where people can just log on and georeference maps. Just take a map that you already have georeference or with spatial characteristics, and then you take another raster where you don't have that, like a paper map, a scan of a paper map, and you can just match up the points, and that will draw the other map to where it should be. And you can also assess the accuracy, assuming your first map is accurate, assess the accuracy of the second map. We do a lot of map regression work for our desk-based studies, and digital data providers like the National Library are very, very useful sources for that kind of stuff. This project is one I ran this summer where georeferencing and accuracy analysis was crucial. This is an Iron Age promontory fort on the banks of Loch Shiel up in the Highlands. I said that properly, but something like that. It's an Iron Age site with a big stone bank wall around it and a big orthostats in the centre forming two cells. We were commissioned by the Forestry Commission to go up and survey it, and we suggested using photogrammetry, and they were happy for us to experiment with that. So, first off, on the site, we arrived with an EDM, a total station, and did an outline survey of the archaeological features. And then we started to do our photogrammetry survey, which was quite straightforward in terms of equipment. All we need is a photo pole, a camera on the top of the photo pole, and a trigger down below. And we've gone over the site backwards and forwards and taken about 2,000 photographs to build up a very detailed photographic record. We can then process those photographs using special photogrammetry software. We spent about 2 days doing this, by the way. And that gives us all our camera positions and a sparse point cloud showing the topography of the site. So even this result would be good for a topographic survey. But when that's fully processed, this is the result we got, which was a point cloud with 40 million points. It was interesting that the process didn't actually capture areas with vegetation. You can see a couple of gaps up there, but we weren't upset about that because we know it's just covered in vegetation. It did capture areas below the waterline up to about 30 centimetres, which would have been very difficult to do using laser scanning or something like that. So we were very happy with that. That took about 2 weeks to process. If I zoom in on the point cloud, you can see the central feature here, and you can just about make out one of the control points. I'll zoom in a bit more. Just a little fluorescent tag was used. We set up 40 of those. And on the finished survey, the finished point cloud, we were able to identify 37 of them. And we had surveyed the control points with our total station beforehand. So we were able to do an accuracy analysis using the georeferencer function in ArcGIS to establish that the final stitched result of the photogrammetric survey was accurate across the 50 metres of the site to less than 4 centimetres, which was sufficient for meeting English Heritage Survey photogrammetry guidelines. So we were quite happy about that. View sheds, as I said, we use view sheds quite a lot. This one obviously stolen from Wikipedia. That's a view shed that someone's made of a crater on Mars, one of the early Mars missions. But it's a nice illustration. We can use it for setting impacts of developments. It's very simple to do in ArcGIS. All you need is an elevation model and an observer height. It's more versatile than that. You can do more complex things by summing view sheds together. But it's very important to remember that whether you're doing it academically or for a pre-development setting impact assessment, that it's only a model. Your results are only going to be as good as the data you put in. This is a slide that I created for an IFA training course we did recently to demonstrate how view sheds work. Probably most of you are familiar with view sheds. The green cells will be intervisible with the turbine. The red cells will be not intervisible. And so if we were doing a pre-development study, we would know that there would be possibly a setting impact on the church. We might go and visit the church, but almost certainly no impact on the megalithic tomb. So very useful for us. It cuts down our fieldwork time enormously. Cumulative view sheds. I've just put this in. I did a lot of this in my own postgraduate studies, where I was looking at tower houses, and this is a slide from a presentation I gave on that. That's just where you take multiple view sheds and you add them together, and you can build up much more detailed models of how intervisibility works between and that was pioneered by Wheatley in 95, and there's a couple of other people. This is another example from my postgraduate studies, where we looked at, I think, eight castles. Overall, I was looking at most of the county, but this is a small subsample. We looked at eight castles in the south of the county, owned by the same family, the Walshes, originally Welsh. And we looked at the indivisibility of their castles. We were trying to understand the siting of the castles and why they'd been placed where they were in such an open landscape. And the results we came up with from the viewshed analysis seemed to be that they'd been sited to be indivisible with each other, that they weren't close to water courses, they weren't trying to maximise the area of visibility that they had. They just wanted to be able to see each other, and they weren't very interested in who was outside this one valley. So that was quite interesting. If we generate view sheds across a landscape randomly and add them together, we can build up a visibility prominence map of how the most prominent areas of that landscape. This is quite useful for planning studies to try and help with zoning and strategic planning. This is an example that we did on the south coast of England near Portsmouth, where we used a very similar technique. Generated about, I think they used about 300 observer points. And it's interesting to note with these things that it's very distinct from elevation. So a very elevated area might not be that prominent in the landscape if it's also surrounded by very elevated areas. So very useful from that point of view. This is a rapid survey that I ran earlier in the summer as well, also for the Forestry Commission, where we did a topographic survey. We used the elevation points that we got to generate a surface, and then we symbolized, we generated contours, we overlaid a hasher plan. Very useful, something we do a lot of in the company. This is another interesting example of interpolation, also for topography. The dive survey that I was showing earlier, before we went out there, we were sent by a local diver a survey he'd done with an echo sounder on a speedboat a couple of years before. And what we got sent were just eastings and northings, the time of day that they did the survey, and the depth that the echo sounder gave. And he sent us these tracks of where he'd been. It was all about 10 years old, and that's all we got. But using ArcGIS interpolation, we were able to build that up into a much more useful map. We corrected the data tidally because this, off the coast of Scotland, is a 4-meter tidal, 4 to 5 meter tidal range. So a depth is not necessarily a true depth. You have to correct for the tide. We mapped out the coordinates in GIS. We transformed it into the planar coordinate system that we were working in. We interpolated using, I think, Creevy for that one, elevation points between all the known elevation points. And we symbolized and contoured the map appropriately. This is a screen grab from Admiralty Total Tide, where we were able to go back through to the date that the survey was done and pull out the tidal ranges at that date. I think it was 2001. We ended up with that map, which is much more useful, obviously, than an Excel spreadsheet. Another example of interpolation, also kind of topography, but not necessarily. This is Olympic Park. We've just produced a monograph on that, detailing all the work we did there, just in time for the end of the Olympics. And for this site, it was a very large site, but we were very fortunate to have a huge amount of geotechnical borehole data. And the kind of thing you very rarely get given before you do one of these studies. You can see the density of boreholes here goes up as high as 20 in places. Using the cores from those boreholes and the depths of the various deposits that were encountered along a density of borehole data that we're able to even model things like paleo channels. And we have similar models for every period right up to the present, which is very useful. Raster-based analysis is something we don't do a huge amount of. It depends very much on the project. One thing that we do quite a lot of is relative sea level change stuff, which there's probably a couple of experts here on that, no doubt. To do relative sea level change analysis, it can all be done through rasters. There are other ways to do it, but an easy way is to use rasters in ArcGIS. There's four factors you need to account for. Isostasy, which is the... as you go back through prehistory to the early Mesolithic and Paleolithic, there were huge, the end of the Ice Age, there were huge glaciers sitting on the land surface, and the effect that they had was to depress the Earth's crust in those areas. And as they receded, it sprang back up. So if you're looking for old coastlines, you need to take that into account. Eustacy, which is the general sea level change. As the glaciers melted, sea levels rose up. And that's quite easy to model because it's almost uniform across the globe. Isostasy is a very low thing. You need a lot of relative sea level curves to do that. Obviously, you need bathymetry, so what the current elevation is of the seabed. And then it helps if you have some understanding of processes of erosion and deposition over the last couple of thousand years. This is something that's very difficult to get your hands on, though. It requires a lot of field work and analysis and some speculation. So you can see... This particular model is based solely on eustacy, which is sea level change. And that's a very simple thing, a simple raster calculation to do. We're working on stuff in the Western Isles at the moment for the OCMAP project, which is more involved. So you can see that by 2704 present, the sea level is very similar. And a lot of that sea level change there is more due to erosion. Wessex Archaeology as a company also does a wide variety of training and specialist GIS services for various people. Earlier this year, myself and Dr. Bickett ran a course with the IFA, and that was very interesting, the kind of people we had turning up to that. People who'd been in archaeology for a long time and were finding that GIS was more and more necessary for what they wanted to do. So we had people from the university, we had consultants from other archaeological companies, big consultancies where they had GIS support but they didn't have much training in place. We had very small archaeological consultancies or one-man band archaeologists turning up. We had environmental specialists who found that they needed it to do more detailed environmental analysis. And we also had various staff from government agencies. We're hoping to try and run some more short courses like that using similar material and maybe looking at more open source GIS stuff as well, because we had a lot of feedback that people were finding it quite expensive to get their hands on ArcGIS licenses. Wessex does GIS outsourcing where a client or an agency of some kind might wish to retain us for specialist GIS work on an ongoing basis. We have a couple of agreements like that in place at the moment. The English offices have embedded a couple of people with local council archaeological services to enhance their HGR databases, for example. And we also get quite a lot of project-specific commissions where someone has a GIS problem and they'll just hire one of our specialists in to go off to their offices, or they come down to our offices and we just work through whatever GIS-related problem they've come up against. We're a whole variety of issues to be aware of from a professional archaeological standpoint. I've put up a couple of bullet points there, but I could have put up dozens more. Given the economic climate at the moment, we're finding that our data providers are under attack. Their funding is being cut, and that can lead to problems with the planning process if those data providers don't have enough staff and services to roll out data to us and enhance that data in-house, which is crucial. Software and data costs, we come up against this quite a lot. Generally, we try and pass the costs on to our clients so that we don't have to deal with it too much. But for our clients, it can be very expensive, and if you're not in an academic institution, software costs can be extremely high for some of the GIS software. Decentralized data is a serious problem for us. When we're doing these kind of planning studies where we're drawing together huge amounts of data from different places, we could spend days and weeks dealing with the GIS aspects rather than the archaeology, trying to get GIS data from various people, trying to deconflict the data, trying to understand the history of the data and what's wrong with it. And it can make the whole process a lot more expensive, time-consuming, and unreliable. Which is why for most synthesis projects, we will take all the data sets, and rather than doing some kind of automated synthesis, we'll have to work through each single record manually and produce a very complex gazetteer with concordance to all the different data sets that we use to generate that record. Trained graduates is obviously something that's quite relevant to this course that's coming up. We do have trouble sourcing people who have a knowledge of GIS. We recently advertised for a data officer, our main data officer in our Salisbury office, and we were surprised by the lack of response and the general lack of experience of the people who applied. We were lucky in the end that we got an extremely well-qualified graduate, but there's still a huge number of archaeologists, probably more than half of the archaeologists I've worked with over the last 10 years who have any experience with GIS. So I think it's very important that people get a basic understanding, at least, of GIS in university. It's almost as crucial as having a driving license. You'll find that those are the two main things people ask about sometimes. Collaboration is something that I'm very keen to push forward, and our whole company is very keen to push forward, trying to find ways that all the stakeholders in heritage GIS data can come together and swap ideas and work on standards. There's a huge amount of stuff to be done there. The Royal Commission is particularly good at this kind of thing. And we've had a lot of discussions. I've personally been speaking to the Royal Commission's marine data person quite a lot recently about how best to move forward and what pre-developments archaeologists need from the Commission. So that's more or less the end. I'm not sure what time I've used up, but a few points I'd just like to highlight. Heritage data, obviously GIS is very important for archaeologists and heritage people because almost all the data that we work with has a geographic character. Archaeological sites are somewhere, and so it's easier to deal with them in a geographically intelligent environment. It's a core skill for people working in archaeology, whether you're an academic or whether you're working for a state agency or a charity. Not everyone needs to be a wizard with GIS. As long as you have access to a wizard, that's probably enough. But it helps a lot to have just the basic knowledge and understanding what GIS is. It's definitely a growth area. It's when I first got into it, Queen's University had a huge lab of expensive computers and no one using them. since then, it's cropping up more and more. We probably use it for almost every single project we've done. We do hundreds of projects every year. And one of the first things I'll do when I start a project is I'll start an MXD and I'll start to bring in all the data and I'll just manage my data using a program like that. And it's not a terribly dull thing to be involved in, even though it's very computer-based. I find that it's drawn me into a lot of very interesting projects over the years. You might be looking for some assistance with GIS, and then you just get drawn into the project and you're able to enhance their results and enhance their analysis. And for me, it's only one part of what I do, which is the way I'd like to keep it, I suppose. I don't want it to just be a GIS bot, but I do enjoy it as well. So that's about the end of it.
Right. Well, try with this number, I'll try and field questions. I think I can see you all. Anyone like to go first? Questions for John? Just wired by maps. A huge number of our new students here.
A lot of the work that you're doing for developers and things, obviously the sites there for maritime is something that's built so that you know the data is what you're left with, the site's not really in that condition. Yeah. Are there steps that you need to take to make that data then available to other people openly, or are there steps you take to make sure that the data you have in a format that will be usable in the future?
Yeah, well, just as an archaeologist, there's the concept is called preservation by record, so that you destroy a site even when you excavate it for research purposes, and no one can then go along and look at that site ever again. So, you know, the concept of just don't destroy it as much as possible is preservation by preservation, I suppose, is much better because, you know, technological advances happen all the time. If a site was excavated before radiocarbon dating was available, then the opportunity to radiocarbonate the remains has been lost. So the best thing to do is just to not destroy it at all. If we were rigid about that, we wouldn't be able to build anything at all. So inevitably, when you're developing, you're going to have some impacts on cultural heritage, on the archaeological horizon. So there are very strict standards about how we record sites, how we archive our remains, you know, the reports and the finds. Everything will be archived with the commission. There will be a Discovery and Excavation Scotland report that will get published immediately after the year that the work happens. And generally what we try and do is publish academically the results of anything we've done, unless it's completely tedious, like a watching brief. Find anything. We'll try and do a publication. I have about six or seven of them sitting on my tray at the moment. So. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I was thinking of like kind of data standards and particular. So obviously these things can move on, and maybe sites you've recorded about 10 years ago in some, like say, for example, like your geodatabase in 10 years' time, is that still going to be reasonable? Do you have to say that?
Yes, well, there's long-term data archiving standards. The Commission has published a digital archiving standard for various projects. We work with GIS metadata standards like Inspire and Medin for offshore stuff. And all of our work, as much as possible, comply with those standards. Increasingly so. It's usually now being included as part of a project brief, so that it's just part of our contract to do it. And we've instituted data standards in the company that mean that any shape files, for example, that go out must have full metadata, and the metadata is quality assessed by a data officer before it goes out. In terms of what kind of files you can archive, obviously some of the software we work with changes quite a lot, especially if it's relatively new software, so it can be difficult, but there are set formats that we work in. data gathering point of view, we're seeing more and more GIS data becoming available. We're seeing more intelligently put together GIS data. There's a lot of initiatives on at the moment that the Commission are quite heavily involved in to build spatial frameworks to make data accessible through web portals and things like that. We're seeing standards being applied increasingly, as I said. On a basic archaeological, for basic archaeological stuff in Scotland, we're just seeing the databases get simplified and deconflicted a lot before we even get them. And the more of that we see, the better. In terms of people's training, you know, I've been really surprised coming to Wessex how many people use GIS. Before that, the companies I worked in, it was me and maybe a couple of other guys, and that was before I started my own master's and gotten very experienced with it. Coming to Wessex, everyone uses GIS. It's a standard thing that everyone does for every project, and I expect that's going to happen more and more, that every person working in archaeology and in any kind of environmental discipline will be working with GIS constantly.
You said that you worked and then you were using GIS, and then you've gone to your postgrad GIS. Do you think that working in it first helped, or is it the same kind of thing, area?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's the same software as well, so definitely very useful. I worked for a long time with GIS, where I was just using it to create maps and to synthesize data, and my experience never expanded beyond that for a couple of years. Especially when I started doing my master's, I got much more involved in it, and working with Wessex Archaeology, it's more important to understand things like projections and transformations, because we work offshore and we do a lot of just a bigger variety of stuff. So when I started in college, I haven't got a huge boost, I suppose, from the work I've been doing. Definitely, you know, probably when I left Queen's, I was a bit less familiar with all the constituent parts of a shape file, things like that. I got the sort of very basic stuff very solidly.
John?
Yeah.
Sure. You mentioned earlier on that you can have paleo-environmental or environmental archaeological data in your GISs. Do your clients ever ask you, or do you ever use that data, do you ever interpolate it to make landscape reconstructions and sites that you're working on?
Yes, we do. Especially in England, from the Salisbury office, and Phil Harding actually is a great Paleolithic specialist and a Flint expert, and we've done a lot of landscape reconstruction of various quarries, because there's a couple of big quarries down there that they're just exposing whole Paleolithic landscapes, and they're turning up tons of hand axes and things like that. Our Edinburgh office, we're fortunate to have Dr. Benjamin, Jonathan Benjamin, who's a fellow at the university here as well, and he's a specialist in submerged prehistoric landscapes. So we're trying to push from our office to for offshore developers to take more notice of the submerged prehistoric landscape offshore, which could be a huge thing in Scotland. So yeah. Does that clarify that? Or?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, probably for a standard development project, we wouldn't do a lot of it. Basically, because the data isn't available. Only where we can, where there's been geotechnical core. I guess you'll pick up some on the paleo-environmental side. Yeah.
There's one over here.
John, in terms of the research, you obviously spent a long time on that prompt wandering over the photo pole, and you were talking about the cells, which looked like they were GIS then help you pull apart, tease apart the phasing on that site? Is that helpful for that?
Well, the phasing for that particular site was very difficult. I spoke to a couple of people, including George, at the commission about it. So, what we think was happening is that there's a big cell here, because the stones that made up this were a lot smaller. And then this cell is mainly made of larger orthostats and seems to be superimposed. And this seems to be a collapsed wall. But the line of that wall runs into the bank that surrounds the whole site. And then what we think is happening is that there's a couple of sheep pens that have been built against it in the possibly the medieval period. But there was no excavation above, so phasing was very difficult. But the point cloud definitely helped because we were able to look at it in a three-dimensional environment. And as well as the point cloud, we generated a mesh model of the central feature. And yeah, it's just, I mean, for any archaeological site, if you had a very detailed 3D model, it would be extremely useful. Something I've been working a lot on lately and trying to develop. And interestingly, we found it works underwater as well, so we need some of that.
Somebody, two questions. I'll take two more questions, I think, and then we'll allow you to chat to John after. So I think.
I'm sorry, does your use of GIS kind of come secondary to the case you studied, or do you ever use GIS to kind of examine where there could be archaeological finds?
Well, GIS normally will, as in the workflow, we'll do our data collection and synthesis before we go near the site. So for any site that I'm working on, even if there isn't a budget necessarily or isn't part of our brief to do a data collection, because some of the GIS data has been made available easily, I can just pull that in straight away and go down there with an informed opinion. As part of the EIA process, we also have to, we'll do a site visit and a walkover usually, but we also have to do an assessment of we'll look at the known archaeology, but we need to assess the potential for more archaeology to be there. Because obviously what we see on the surface isn't the full picture. So yeah, GIS is very important for that. We'll get a data set like the Royal Commission's, and we'll when we're ordering the data, so just to make sure it's the most up-to-date, we'll order a much bigger area. You know, it could be, depending on the size of the development, you could order in kilometres of extra data, which doesn't cost any extra from the commission, and then we can just go through that and try and get a full understanding of the kinds of site that occurred throughout the whole landscape.
So your choice of location is always determined by the client, or?
Oh yeah, we'll be given an area that we work in. We'll have a limited influence on things like that. They'll have an envelope that they work inside, and then we can help them with design inside that envelope. But that envelope will be constrained by the fact that they own the land, that it's zoned properly, things like that. So compared to an academic study where you might be looking at something thematically, we're usually, when we're doing pre-development work, we're looking at a specific area and everything that ever happened in that area that we can get our hands on.
Final question.
Did you say, did you skip back to
the
question before? Do you think there might be
I don't think so, no. I mean, excavation needs to happen if the site's going to be destroyed, if it's a significant site and it's going to be destroyed. You know, as I said, with this site, you know, we can't be certain of our dating. We think it's Iron Age based on morphology and some similar examples, but we can't be certain about that until we excavate it. So at the moment, remote sensing is still definitely second place to excavation. If the site's not going to be destroyed, then it's very useful, and it's the best thing to do because you don't want to get in and damage the site to understand it if you can help it. But you
actually, if anyone's interested in finding out about the whole landscape without being constrained by a client, I happen to be reading Francis Pryor's tome, The Making of the British Landscape, I think, which is seems to be quite gripping, but it's a full book. Anyway, so worth a look if you're interested. Right, I should just say thanks to the volunteers for helping set up, before I do anything else. Do you know, help yourselves to what's left, and come and chat to John. We'll move over before too long across the TV at Library Bar for the AGI Geo drinks. So you're welcome to join us there, but finish off here. And okay, next talk is 2 weeks' time. And we'll have Dr. Max Roberts of Essex University talking about the psychology of transport network maps, increasing use of public transport. So all things network for the students, they'll just have done their network practical. Hopefully he'll tell us about surviving the Olympics as well. So look forward to that. Thanks for coming. Cheers. Thanks.